Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, April 2nd, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted that you could join me this evening. Tonight is our first quarter wrap-up. I plan to do a wrap-up at the beginning of every quarter, so there'll be one in the first week of July, and then the first week of October, and then a year-end wrap-up at the end of December. The year-end wrap-up that we did for 2008 was recorded on December 28th, and if you haven't heard it and are interested, the MP3 is in the archive, and also at your control panel is a link to the wrap-up in text form as well. I've reviewed all your questions both at the blog and at the control panel, and I've integrated them into my comments tonight. A few words first on money and markets. We've had an extraordinary global equity rally with the Dow literally running up 1,500 points in not that much more than a week. And if you look underneath what's really happening, the Fed has been pumping the market incredibly. The Fed literally in several days has purchased about $23 billion of treasuries and injected incredible liquidity in the market. And if you look at the trailing PEs of the S&P 500 or the Dow, they are up against expected corporate earnings. They are this is beyond bubble. It's some new kind of stratospheric bubble. So my expectation, you know, I keep talking every time we get together about the key dates in the shakeout. We're coming in the next key date. We've been through March 15th in the pension fund reporting and corporate tax filings and a lot of the corporate SEC document filings for their annual report. Now we're coming into tax time, and it's a particularly, for individuals, April 15th is a particularly tense time. To give you a sense, it's expected that individuals in America will pay $1 trillion in taxes. Well, that's the same amount of money that the Secretary of the Treasury has just proposed to essentially gift to the banks. With mighty profits to the funds who work out the so-called toxic assets. So this was a pretty tense time, and somehow goosing the stock market has cut a little of the tension. But we still have the summer and the fall shakeout to work through. So now is the time to be extremely cautious and don't be seduced by a market that thinks that our car companies going down and our banks being full of criminal toxic assets is the basis of a real strong equity valuation. So beware the summer and fall shakeout to come. Okay, so let's go through. I posted the outline in my comments on the wrap-up. And the outline is there. The first comment I wanted to make was about the G20 meeting that occurred today in London, and I called it Davos G20 and the Midianite thing. The World Forum met in Davos, Switzerland earlier, and there was a great deal of fighting and falling out. And then coming into the G20 meeting, we saw the beginnings of great fighting, and what seems to have come out of the G20 meeting is a great press release. I posted it up on the blog, but I suspect behind the scenes we're still seeing some very big tension. I called it the Midianite thing, and I just want to introduce that concept to you because it's a word that I like to use, and it comes from a story in the Old Testament where Gideon throws the Midianites out of Israel, and Gideon has a tiny army that has no weapons. And what happens is the Midianites jump up. Gideon comes down the side of a mountain with 300 men with lanterns and pitchers, and a much larger army of Midianites are sleeping in the valley, and they're so distrustful and suspicious of each other that they jump up in the middle of the night and kill each other. And that's what I call the Midianite thing. And one of the reasons I encourage everyone who believes in freedom and decentralization to do everything we can to withdraw our resources from the pro-centralization sort of hierarchies and to bring illumination in a positive way to what they're doing is it really encourages the Midianite thing. Because what happens, if anybody's ever worked in a campaign, what you know is as you work on the campaign, everybody gets hopes up that they're going to get different positions in whatever the new administration is that they're all shooting for. And then as the campaign is won and the reality sets in, what happens is a lot of people who thought they were insiders get dumped. And not everybody, you know, only so many people can be the equivalent of cabinet secretaries. And the same thing is happening as we're coming into new, you know, the push to centralize and the push for one world government. You have more and more people competing for fewer and fewer spots, and awful lot of tensions coming to the fore as cultural differences and various things happen. And frankly, the you know, the chances that the Midianites literally start fighting with each other increase. So coming into G20, we saw a lot of Midianite thing happening. One of the things that was most exacerbating the discussions was the pressure to get countries that have been much more financially prudent to start to print money and engage in stimulus, and to the extent that we are. And they have the good sense to know that that's not prudent. The resolution was that IMF would print $1 trillion. I did a calculation because great spin is being made out of this $1 trillion. But if you look at the numbers and you just say, okay, well, it took the Fed $23 billion to pump up the stock market this week. $1 trillion is enough to really keep the markets pumped up for 43 days. So, or if you look at the administration has basically put into the banks the combined bailouts last year, or just the last 12 months, are about $12 to $14 trillion. So $1 trillion for 6 billion people on the whole planet, $1 trillion is a lot of money. It's the equivalent to all the taxes we collectively are going to pay in the United States this year. But if you look at the size of the problem, it's not, it shouldn't make a whole lot of difference. It makes for great press release. The other things that G20 put forward is a call for more global regulation. It's hard to tell from the press release exactly what that really means. There's a desire to go after tax havens, not as much to shut off privacy and get more control, as for many of the reasons that are given. It's important to understand that regulation in this country was used to promote the bubble and the fraud. For example, the story of Hamilton Securities is a great example of regulators being used to get rid of the honest people. So more regulation is not necessarily going to help, although certainly regulating hedge funds and regulating derivatives or outlawing derivatives even is something that's going to have to happen. So there's talk of more regulations. It's hard to say what that means. Finally, the IMF, they're proposing yet again that the IMF sell its gold, and we saw the gold price drop $10 or $20 as a result. It's one of the funniest things, one of the most entertaining times I have in my life is when the threat of selling the IMF gold gets pulled out of the closet and the gold price gets trounced as a result. And the gold, all the gold folks go crazy because they've seen this tactic used many times before. And then, of course, the IMF doesn't sell its gold. And so today was no different, with Chris Powell of GATA just setting off because here comes this ruse again. This time, though, I do think there's a possibility of some not the IMF gold coming into the open market and hitting the price, but some swaps with Russia and China. Coming into G20, we had Russia and China making incredible noises about concern about the dollar, wanting to hold gold, proposing gold as a standard, indicating there's a lot more cooperation between Russia and China. China announcing that it was engaging in currency swaps with a variety of its trading partners so that all that pretty significant trading volume doesn't have to occur in dollars. So Russia and China are making a lot of noises, and there's no doubt if they're going to accumulate as much gold as they have at various times indicated that they want, that IMF or central bank direct swaps with Russia and China, sort of off market, could be one of the things that's coming up here as a possibility. It's important to note that the more and more markets are managed and price are managed, we're seeing more things trade off market. And so the idea of big currency swaps between different trading partners starting to occur off market or growing off market would be sort of in alignment with that whole trend. Okay, so next topic, geography is destiny. I always try and encourage people, particularly Americans. If you've been educated in the American educational system, you probably have not spent as much time learning about geography and the importance of geography and its sort of interaction with politics and with the economy as would help you understand events. To really understand events in our world, whether at the global level, the national level, the local level, and to see the opportunities, it's essential to understand geography and relate it to the things that you use in your life and where you invest your time and your money. It's very important for your local situation. And when you talk to many Americans, they're remarkably not knowledgeable about the geography of their place. And if you're interested in what I call mapping financial ecosystems, it's almost more important to first understand the geography and history of your place. And the history is very tied up, of course, with geography. Now, one of the things that's bringing geography to the fore is climate change and all sorts of environmental issues, which are certainly making people more sensitive to the impact of their physical environment on them. I just was talking with Gary on the calls because anybody in the South today knows that we're having severe thunderstorms and tornado watches in about 15 different states. But all of these things are focusing us on that. But the other thing is, as we move out of a bubble economy where paper was important and into a market where tangibles is the rising asset class, it's going to focus back on basics. It's going to focus us on food. It's going to focus us on water. The reality is, there's a great quote up on the blog that says, that we owe our existence to the fact that we have a great layer of topsoil and it rains. And really, between topsoil, rain, and sunlight, those three things bring us much of our wealth. There's one, the editor of Acres magazine just died. There's a post up sort of in his honor on the blog a couple weeks ago. And one of the things he said was that the GNP is really a multiple of farm income. And so if you look deeply at our economic problems, one of our economic problems is that we've centralized agriculture. We've done it in a way which is very harmful to the topsoil. And if we're going to address real economic problems, it's important to look at those issues. You'll always see up at our website and the blog the question, who's your farmer? You really want to start to ask and answer that question, because building local resiliency means creating redundant sources of food locally. And what I'm seeing, the reason I'm bringing this up in the wrap-up, what I've seen in the first quarter, which is so positive and really tells me that something wonderful is happening despite all the craziness, is that people are really beginning to get interested in the geography of their place and the natural resources in their place, and they want to heal from this sort of disassociation from place. I just saw the latest James Bond movie, Quantum of Solace, and it was it's a terrible movie, but it's a great description of sort of how the green movement can be misused for all sorts of control of natural resources, and it really focuses you on the importance of water and the sort of coming, or I guess it's here now, the squabble globally about water. I've been asked a lot of questions about how to map out local financial ecosystems, and we put a post up on our blog to give people a beginning of where to start. But I want to point out that there are a couple ways you can really start to dig in and understand geography. The best one I know, believe it or not, is once a year to read the World Almanac, because the World Almanac is simply a compendium of what are all the resources in the world, you know, who are all the people in the world, and just laying them out statistically. And you get a wonderful sense. If somebody said to me, well, I want to learn about how to invest, the first thing I would say is, well, you need to understand the geography of the people and resources on our planet. But the second thing is, I created a curriculum, and this is on the blog post I referred to, called Economics 101, where I try and teach people economics, or lay out a way to learn economics that really is focused on your local economy. In May or June, we're going to be doing one or more Solari reports on how to map out your local financial ecosystems. And that one that one or two is going to be important because, and let me tell you a story. I had a wonderful person whose church has started a group for unemployed members of the congregation. And apparently it's what's supposed to be a very fairly wealthy neighborhood, suburb. And apparently this group is just growing and growing and growing, and they're all very talented people. And what I said to them is, why don't you have the group, instead of talking about how they get a job, because there are no jobs, why don't you have them start to map out their local financial ecosystems? Because by mapping out all the money in their community, particularly the state and local and federal government flows, that's where you're going to find the, in essence, inefficiencies or arbitrages that you can start to find ways of reengineering those flows in a way that creates jobs or incomes for people in the group. So what's going to happen as the economy sort of squeezes down is we're going to find the opportunity to create income for ourselves, many of us, by mapping out those financial local ecosystems. Okay, Obama, change bankers can count on. I think one of the hardest things for me personally is every 4 years I watch so many wonderful people in America and around the world invest an incredible amount of personal time and money and energy in watching the pro-centralization team pick somebody to help them centralize the economy. And that's all time and energy that could be used to, used us to help take action to kind of shift things. Obama has now, in the first, it's less than 90 days of his administration, has now delivered more resources to the private bankers than anyone in the history of the country. It's quite extraordinary. And if you look at the amount of political capital that Obama was able to accumulate, in part thanks to, you know, it's a good guy, bad guy, or good cop, bad cop routine, but Bush played a perfect bad cop. And Obama has accumulated a tremendous amount of political capital and is now using that to basically do things which are, at this point it's hard to say that there really is a constitution or a law. But the numbers are quite extraordinary. We put up a blog post to count them, and we're now up to $12 to $14 trillion. Now, that includes what happened in the last year under Bush, but if you look at the extent to which Obama used his credibility to deliver that, he really put it over the top. One of the things that's happened is, for many years I tried to warn people about the collateral fraud and the extent of the criminality in the mortgage markets. What's been fascinating, though, is to watch, it's very hard for financial people to fathom that things are really that bad. What you've seen happen with this last go-round of Geithner's plan to recapitalize toxic assets with the help of private investors and a variety of different government financings and guarantees is you finally made it clear to more and more people that that these assets are really seriously fraudulent, and there really is a big black hole in the financial system. I wanted to tell a story that's up on the blog, and it's sort of a very famous concept in the, or it's a famous old story in the financial community, but let me just read it to you. The story goes that sometimes in the early years of the 20th century, there was a lull on the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, a lull that extended for hours into days, and the boys were getting bored and restless. Come an afternoon for one of any better entertainment, one of the traders pulled out an elderly sardine tin and announced his willingness to sell this unique item for no more than a nickel. In a moment, two jobbers from the railroad's pitch had bid and counterbid for the tin, pushing the price up to a dime. Not to be outdone, the swells who trade Texas oil stocks jumped in, doubling the price of their sardines, then doubling it again. The tin passes from professional hand to professional hand, with the ticket sometimes a cent or two higher, sometimes up a quarter. At last, the hubbub attracts the attention of the baby of the floor, a wet behind the ears college kid. He spots the unusual label and can't miss the excitement and the open outcry yelling of the traders. The kid, determined to show he can play with the big boys, and generally intrigued by the apparent rarity of the item, firmly calls out $10 and is delighted when the bidding comes to an abrupt end. Hefting out his pocket knife, he punctures the tin only to be met with the unmistakable stink of rotting fish. Bewildered and heavily out of pocket, the new boy turns to one of his elders and betters, who had taken a half-dollar turn out of the tin an hour previously. "I don't get it," said the kid. "These sardines are long gone." "Son," says the old jobber, "those weren't eating sardines. Them were trading sardines." Now, what we're seeing with the trillion-dollar toxic program is the banks are literally taking these assets and pumping and dumping them one more time. They're making a whole new round of profits off of the fraud, and they're doing it in a way where no one can see the assets, no one can do diligence them. It literally happens behind closed doors. The final proof of that, even shocking the Wall Street Journal, which I posted up on the blog, is that they've now announced that the only funds that will be allowed to participate as private investors in this program are funds that already have $10 billion of toxic assets on their balance sheet. Now, that brings this down to a very exclusive club, and kills any notion of competition, creating liquidity in a market. I mean, it basically closes the shop, pumps and dumps some trading sardines for some more profit, and really, you know, it's almost a combination of a pump and dump and a shredding program. And I think one of the things that's building in the general population, including the financially sophisticated population, is an understanding that whatever is going on, it's not a legitimate effort to manage or govern in any way, shape, or form related to either the laws or sort of the history of good practices of managing whether an economy or private companies or public companies. Okay, your pension fund and 401k, the question I get the most, both at the Solari Report control panel, as I give speeches or just walk around in my life, is should I take my money out of a 401k? Do I need to be concerned about government intervention or regulation of a 401k? I've written several pieces on this, and there's nothing new I can say about it, other than what I've said before many times, which is I'm deeply disturbed by the efforts to control and the sort of the spin that's coming out on 401ks. At the same time, it's a terrible you know, disadvantage to take your money out of those accounts. So there's nothing to do here but watch it. However, I really I want to emphasize to everyone that if you look at the range of any person's assets, there's assets we control, and then there's assets which are subject to a variety of other controls. And then there are assets, for example, most pension funds, which are very clearly controlled by someone else. And we literally need, for planning purposes, to realize that the less control we have, the more subject they are to certain kinds of risks, and we just need to be prepared and plan on even in the worst case, living without them. So I think these are things that just need to be watched. You know, but no one knows. Clearly, if you look at the fundamental economics of our situation, the people running things are running the economy in a non-productive way, and so they have constant need of subsidy. And unfortunately, anybody with assets is potential subsidy. I also posted on the blog today, sort of in the retirement planning section, or in a section of my comments, but I did post in the blog under Money and Markets, or it will come up tomorrow. There was an article on Yahoo saying that the indications were that there would be no cost of living rises in the Social Security because of cost of living index. Their expectation it would be flat for 3 years. Now, given the inflation we're seeing or I expect to see in many different kinds of things, particularly foodstuff, this is pretty unnerving, and it really goes to the heart of how the slow burn works to kind of drain people who are not insiders. But that's also one to keep an eye on. I wanted to talk, let me turn to local crime, disinformation, and covert ops, because one of the things I've done, I've studied a lot of what happens in other countries around the world when in the 90s and in the last 9 years, when you hit a bad economic patch, what happens, what do people do that succeeds, what do people do that causes trouble. And one theme you see again and again is that crime rises. As more and more, as unemployment grows, the social fabric breaks down, and you have more petty and local crime, and it's generally on the rise. And I think it's worth everyone on the Solari report thinking about and taking some time to talk with people in your family. If they're neighbors you know and trust, talk with them as well. It's a good time to get to know, if you can, your local sheriff. Most police departments have community meetings or other ways that you can communicate. Now, you have to be careful when you go outside of people you know well, because the existing criminal flows in every community, the drug trafficking, the mortgage fraud, those operations are threaded throughout every aspect of our society, including local police and sheriff at times. So you have to, you know, sort of be careful. But generally, I find that the local enforcement is very much interested in making sure the community is safe. It's important for local business. And so it's very important to think about what you can do and how you can do it. Again, other countries have experienced significant rises. There is a lot of disinformation about crime, and I've noticed where I live and reports from all over the Solari network, a lot more rumors that I'm concerned are started by what I call covert operations. One of the things that is a concern is I have had reported repeatedly to me by members of the intelligence communities that various riots historically have been started by shutting off the drug flow. And occasionally you'll see rumors of threats to shut off the drug flow. Because remember, illegal drugs are a major business and a major source of cash flow for a variety of people in America. And so if any of those covert ops start, it's something to watch out for. So there's local crime that is, you know, good old-fashioned random crime. But then there's crime related to ongoing, I can only call it organized crime. And it's very helpful to be able to differentiate between the two, because in many instances how you protect yourself from the two are different. But I expect both of them potentially to rise, and really for citizens to be, it's essential for us to take matters into our own hands in terms of organizing to protect ourselves. One of the things I wanted to mention was we've seen a variety of shooting incidents in the press recently, and I think it's very important to tell you that that there is such a thing as what I call a mind control operation. And there, I've mentioned in earlier Solari reports that there are some great movies that help you understand mind control. There's a new Manchurian Candidate movie with Denzel Washington. The Bourne Identity series is about mind control. Probably the best one is Charles Bronson. It's an old movie called Telefon, T-E-L-E-F-O-N. Another one, Long Kiss Goodnight, with Gina Davis and Samuel Jackson, is very good. So there's a whole series of mind control, but be very careful when you see these shooting stories and they build political support for gun control. If you take any lesson from these shooting stories, I would argue strenuously that the lesson should be it's very important that the right to bear firearms be affirmed and protected. And it's very important if any of those should happen in your area that I would be very discreet about trying to inquire what had happened. I would avoid any grief counselor operations brought in by government. I would just stay away from any institutional efforts in your area. And it really does pay to inform yourself about mind control and how it works using those movies. And with that said, it's also important to take extra precaution to protect your children in this environment from both kinds of crime. So I know that we're all very careful about the children in our life, but now is the time to be super, super, super careful. So that's it for crime. And just remember, I'm going to talk later about the importance of planning your time, but if the economy continues to deteriorate, one of the things that can eat up a lot of your time is local crime. So I'll get to that later. Print media consolidates. We've seen incredible reports of print media either shutting down or running into serious financial problems or switching just to online. But there's a real shakeout happening in print media, and I suspect it's not just going to be in print media. We're going to see it show up eventually in TV programming and in other sort of institutional areas. The Pew Foundation just published a survey that showed church attendance and membership dropping, which surprised me because usually during periods of economic difficulty, you'll see spiritual organizations rising in attendance, but we're not. We're seeing, or at least if this survey is correct, we're seeing the opposite. It wouldn't surprise me if, as we move through the shakeout, if more and more people realize that a variety of these different institutions, whether it's media or churches, have participated or sort of gone along with the bubble and not warned them about what they need to know. And I think we're coming into a period of tremendous shift in what institutions maintain support from people. So, I encourage everybody in this group to always, again, as you look to protect your time, to shift away from people who are not helping you deal with what's really, or either see what's really going on or deal with it correctly. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's something happening and it's going to accelerate, and that the people who, now, in this process, what is happening, and this is happening particularly with the unemployment, we have more and more good people with real talent and ability who are finding themselves literally dumped outside of the bubble. So they had good jobs in the bubble, or they were going along with the bubble. They find themselves dumped out. Many of them thought they were insiders, and now they find themselves dumped out and outsiders. And one of the most important questions in your network and community is, how can we help them make the shift and sort of and move on in a positive way? Because there's an awful lot of talent there. It's interesting, if you go back and look at the stories of what businesses did well in the Depression, what you find is some that really grew tremendously in the Depression were those who identified that this was a great time to build a great workforce, and they found very high quality people that they normally couldn't find whatsoever. Okay, Russia and China and this shift to global governance. As I said before, we've watched incredible announcements by the leadership in China and Russia regarding a desire for a way to trade and sort of a global currency to trade without the U.S. dollar. And it's very hard to tell what's really going on. We had, as I said before, China has agreed to swap its currency with trading partners, Argentina, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Malaysia, South Korea, and then Russia is making noises about wanting gold and going to a partial gold standard. One of the most interesting articles in this whole area was the Rothschild Bank in France had made a preliminary, as an investment group, a preliminary agreement that the Bank of China would invest approximately $300 million. And the government declined to approve in time to meet the deadline. And so the deal is falling through, and you look at that and you think, huh, what's that about? I don't tend to think in terms of sovereign governments. And if you look at the history of, for example, the Cold War, it was the same people financing America as who were financing Russia. And they all made a fortune on the arms race. So if you look at the money we pulled out of the U.S. economy in the 90s, a lot of it was reinvested in Asia, with the biggest reinvestment being China. So when you say China, the question is, who is China? So it's hard to tell what the game is, but it's clearly shifted in terms of, we have coalesced China, Russia. There are a lot of people around the world looking to operate without the U.S., which brings us to our next topic, which is, mirror, mirror on the wall, is the dollar going to fall? And this is a question I ask every day, and I've asked it every day for years. If anything, we posted some charts on the blog that we post every week. We do a Solari report that track the performance of gold in different currencies. And if anything, what those charts say is that the dollar's performance has been phenomenal, and there are many reasons and excuses for it. If you're a subscriber to the Solari Report, you know that I believe it's as much the military and our satellite systems and weaponry that's doing it. But whatever the case is, the reality is that it puts all of us who operate in the dollar in a conundrum. Most Americans are the beneficiary of this kind of spectacular performance of the dollar, because it means we can buy all sorts of goods and services much cheaper than what a real market would price them at. At the same time, the dollar value bears no relation to fundamental economics, which means if the dollar should start to fall, we run the risk that literally it could fall quickly, and we could wake up in a similar kind of situation as the folks in Argentina early in this century, or Russia in the 1990s. So it's kind of a zero or one thing. You go to bed one day and you have $1,000 in the bank, and you wake up the next morning and it's worth zero. So that's why it's important to just keep watching watching this, and I think the big question for me in terms of planning is, are we going to continue to slow burn as we've been doing, or are we going to have a crash this year with a big, big drop in the dollar, particularly if the dollar should ever go off the reserve currency? So those are the two scenarios I keep planning for. One is slow burn, and the other is crash. And that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about in the April Saleri reports. So let's just go through the different opportunity areas. I said in the year-end wrap-up at the end of 2000 that the after-tax yield on stockpiling non-perishables was better than money markets. If it was true in 2008, it got more true in 2009. This is an area, when I first mention this idea to people, they always laugh at me. And I can't tell you how important I think it is. One, because I think it really is a good financial investment. But the other thing is, if you look at the problems we have with geography, with climate change, with weather patterns, you look at the extraordinary drop in the Baltic Dry Index and other indicators of global shipping and trade, there's a real possibility that while goods and services are easy to access now, while the bubble's still dropping and people need to shed inventory, we could hit a time where there are real difficulties. In addition, if the monetary authorities and the Treasury in the United States are literally printing $12 to $14 trillion of money for bailouts, because that money is essentially getting created from thin air. If they're doing that, the possibilities of inflation are rising. Now, clearly what's happening is those potential rising costs are being offset by the deflation that comes from cheap labor. But still, the possibility of inflation or supply hiccups is really great. So making sure that in your household or in your business, you cannot be inconvenienced by any sort of hiccups in your supply lines is so, so important. The other thing is, if we do have a real serious problem with the economy, those goods and services are going to be not only necessary, but they could be valuable. So I would really encourage you to think of building up your non-perishable inventories. Now, what do I mean by that? It's anything you use. People always laugh at me because I talk about paper towels and toilet paper. But it's anything you really absolutely will use that is not perishable. Okay, family, community, and network self-sufficiency. There are, you know, it's so hard to start engaging in a conversation, especially for those of us who live in a place where we don't know our neighbors. But there's so many opportunities to begin to collaborate with our within our personal networks to start to build greater self-sufficiency. And you know, there's sort of endless opportunities, but part of life is getting over the discomfort of organizing. And part of why I want you to do so much to protect your time is this is an area where increased investments in your time can really pay off. Okay, banking intimate. We posted a story that's gotten phenomenal hits on our website about a seizure by the federal government of one of the credit unions that provide wholesale services to the credit unions. And we've gotten a series of questions both by email and on the blog about whether this means you should not bank at a credit union. Absolutely not. If you look at the credit unions and the small community banks, we have many, many institutions that have conducted their finances on a sound basis, and they're exactly where we want to bank. My reports, which are anecdotal from around the country, is that credit unions are getting an influx of deposits and market share. It wouldn't surprise me if that was part of the reason for the seizure, because we see all sorts of indications that the feds and the large banks are trying to solve some of their liquidity problems and some of their financial soundness problems by essentially taking over, buying, or using the smaller institutions. At the same time, you know, it's really, really important to bank at a good bank, a bank run by ethical and competent people, a bank that has run itself properly. And so I really wouldn't worry about, you know, whether that bank runs the risk of being attacked by criminals. I mean, or I wouldn't say you shouldn't necessarily not be aware of that risk, but it's no reason to go bank with criminals. So, you know, yes, the ethical and good banks are subject to more pressure from the regulators, but, you know, I think those are the banks that are going to be the safest place to be. So I would encourage you, if you're not banking locally or banking intimately, please do so. Precious metals. We've seen precious metals got a run up. Many were expecting it to break the $1,000 level. It hasn't. It's backed off to 900. It's up a little bit, 907 today. But so it's basically got pushed down in part from the IMF sales rumor getting pulled out again. What my expectation is that I think we're going to have a really good year for precious metals. It may take a while. We've got the summer is usually not a good period for precious metals, but we've got a shakeout to go through. The powers that be have every reason to want to keep the prices down. If they need to be doing big trades, they can do it off-market and behind the scenes. So my guess is there's going to be pressure, particularly while they're working out the bank assets and doing this new $1 trillion toxic asset program. There's going to be every effort to keep the price of precious metals down. I would just ignore that. We're going to talk a lot more with Franklin Sanders about it next week. I would ignore that because coming into the August, late summer and the fall, we have extraordinary economic issues to deal with, and you want to make sure that you are you and your assets are on solid ground. If there's anything the currency markets have shown over the last year is that there is no such thing as a strong currency, and that's why I think we've seen precious metals hold as well as they've held, even through a sort of deflationary spiral, because people are increasingly understanding the importance of being in real things. Natural resources. Now is the time to start putting together. If you're looking to invest in providing strategic resources for yourself, or you're looking to invest, now is the time to put together your shopping list, because it wouldn't surprise me if during that August to early fall period is when there are going to be extraordinary opportunity to buy natural resources at low price. We just had George Soros announce you know, something to the effect, it'll go up on the blog tomorrow, something to the effect of crashes are great for him, the implication of being great opportunity. But if you look at where invaluable natural resources are pricing, whether you buy them directly, as in you buy real estate or you buy an oil field directly, or in the stock market, the prices are low, and they're getting to the point, or they're expected to get to the point where they're pretty stunning. And I just got back from Europe, and the signs I saw in Europe was there was a lot of capital collecting and watching and waiting for those opportunities. So you know, this is far from a secret, and there's a lot of capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to come in and take advantage of the dump. And this is an area where they're going to really focus. Countries with a strong popsicle index. I wanted to tell a story about something that happened to me earlier this week. I flew last week to Europe, and I flew from Memphis to Chicago on a U.S. carrier, and then I flew from Chicago to Europe on Swiss Air. And same when I came back, I flew back Swiss Air, and then I flew the U.S. carrier back to Memphis. And the comparison between the management and the service of the two airlines was so extraordinary that it literally left me speechless. And on Swiss Air, the plane was immaculate. The flight was just amazing and smooth. The all of the facilities before you got on the plane, when you got off, were clean as a whistle. If you needed anything, the people at the Swiss Air desk were incredibly professional and capable and helpful. And you got a sense on both flights going and coming that you were dealing with a real culture of extraordinary excellence in both management and engineering. And it was literally spotless and impeccable the whole way. When you looked at the U.S. carrier, all the employees were unhappy, disgruntled, communicated that they were overworked or didn't care. Everything was dirty. The plane shook. You kind of wondered if they were going to make it off the ground. And it was as different as night and day. And in one, you felt like you were in a just about the most civilized part, you know, civilized culture in the world. And the other, you felt like you were in a third world country. And now, I say this, and I have to tell you my personal experience for many, many decades with American engineering and management is the talent is extraordinary. We have great engineers. We have great management. There's no reason that a U.S. airline, given our management and engineering talent in this country, shouldn't be absolutely superb. Now, what I know is that the history of this particular airline is one of financial engineering, pumps and dumps, LBOs, and on and on and on. And what you're seeing, and you're seeing it across our society, but certainly you're seeing it in business, is there's only so much financial scamming that the culture of a company can take before it becomes what I experienced on my flight from Memphis to Chicago and back. And so you're literally watching the difference between, you know, what one company that's functioning in a democracy with relatively little corruption impacting it and with a relatively stable and lawful financial system versus a company that's operating in with a corrupt government and a really unstable and speculative financial system. But the impact on the culture and the day-to-day well-being and health of the people is just extraordinary to watch. So with that, when I say countries with a strong popsicle index, I go back to what I said before, geography is destiny. When we come out of this shakeout, I predict that investment in places that do have a strong sense of lawfulness is going to come at a real premium to countries that don't. And so if most U.S. investors are used to investing primarily in U.S. markets and U.S. companies, and so now is the time to start to think about, okay, well, where do I want to invest? Because the value of an enterprise is very much going to be impacted by its geography of both where it's based, where its employees are based, and then where the markets that it serves. So start thinking about where and start thinking in very, very global terms relative to how we've traditionally thought. Okay, enterprises that own and are excellent at serving high popsicle index places, precious metals, natural resources, infrastructure, and essential services, and finally, no waste, new technology or real solutions. If you haven't listened to, we did an audio seminar with John Rubino on, it's an MP3 on green technology, and it's in the archives, and I really recommend that you listen to it because that's going to be an area of incredible opportunity but it's a complex one, and it takes time to understand and figure out. But if you look, even though we're walking through this sort of dire shakeout and dire economic news, it's important to understand that sitting in the laboratories waiting to come out online is incredible technology, which could radically increase productivity globally in phenomenal ways. And that possibility is out there, and it's worth understanding it. Finally, the last opportunity that I always talk about, and again, the opportunities I'm mentioning are listed in the audio seminar, Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, is cash and cash equivalents and strong currencies. And the reality is what we've experienced in the last 3 months is there really is no strong currency. That's part of the squabble. What the squabble at G20 was about, Germany and France not wanting to have aggressive stimulus programs because they don't want to hurt their currencies. I posted an article talking about the Norwegian kroner, mentioning that as a strong currency. But if you look at all these currencies against the dollar, they have not performed well. And if you look at how they're performing against real assets, particularly precious metals, again, they're not performing well. So the message in the first quarter has been fiat currencies are not trustworthy. And so that brings us back to the importance of precious metals and the importance of not being dependent on fiat currency in the worst case. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Solari reports this month. I'm a great believer, as many of you know, I love scenario planning. And my theory is if we have a plan to deal with any scenario, then we don't have to be afraid of it. In fact, we can be opportunistic and take advantage of it. And my other theory is we want to make sure that we and our family and those we love are fine no matter what scenario happens, because no one can know what the future will bring. Well, one of the things I'm a great believer in is planning for the worst scenario, because if you have a plan for the worst case, then you don't have to be afraid of it. I'm a great believer that I think the chances of us continuing to slow burn through 2009 are relatively high, and the chances of a global financial meltdown or crash are relatively low. My assessment of our situation is that we don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem. So every time the sort of global leadership and the leaders of the financial system run our economy in a way that centralizes wealth, what happens is they end up reducing wealth. They shrink the trust, they shrink the liquidity, they shrink the amount of capital that flows to small business where we're getting a lot of our jobs and productivity. So the economy is not being run to create a healthy economy, it's being run to create centralized control. And so we don't have an economic problem, we have a political problem. And I think the nature of the slow burn is it ensures the most control for those who want to centralize, and it does it in a way that it keeps dissent relatively low so that dissent can't really form and change things. The other thing is I can't tell you how many times in my life, and certainly those of us who were concerned about Y2K, I can't tell you how many times I've lived in situations where there was supposed to be a global financial meltdown and the end of the world was supposed to come. I told the story in the blog post about being in the Treasury with the Secretary, then Secretary of Treasury Nick Brady and Alan Greenspan, and a group of people from Treasury who were in charge of working out the last toxic asset program in 1989. And I remember a whole bunch of people coming to me at various times sort of secretly saying, oh, you know, the global financial system is going to melt down, and real fear about that. So I've lived through this many times, and what I've discovered is the planet and the people and the universe have a lot more grace in it than anybody counts on. So I'm not a great believer that the crash is going to come unless it's engineered, which is a possibility. But what I have found is that if you plan for the worst case, it will inspire you to make changes in your life and to shift how you use your time and investment in a way that will be absolutely fantastic for the other scenarios, including the slow burn. So think of it another way. Contemplating the worst case gets you off your duff, or does me, and inspires me to do a whole series of things that I would be reluctant to do if I hadn't gotten scared to death by the worst case, that are just great things for me to do in all scenarios. So that's a long explanation as to why in April I want to go through, we're going to bring in a group of people who are going to scare you to death. But I want to do that because I think it's really worth contemplating what they have to say and beginning to apply what they have to say to our lives. So next week we're going to be talking with Franklin Sanders about precious metals, the precious metals update, but I'm going to talk with him more about the different steps he and his family have taken to protect themselves from the greater economy and changes in the greater economy. Then the following week, the third week in April, we're going to have Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry was, he's a Russian software developer. He was born in Russia, immigrated to the United States as a young man. I think he was 12 years old, and then continued to go back and visit Russia and during the crash in Russia, and so really saw firsthand what happened. If you do a search for his name on our blog, you'll find a couple of links to articles that he's written, and he's written a book that I recommend very strongly called Reinventing Collapse, which is really about the Russian experience and comparing Russia to the United States and why the United States, sort of what happened in Russia, how the United States differs in its organization and what that could mean to really tough economic times here. And I found reading Dmitry Orlov that they're just great ideas, fantastic ideas on how to be prepared for a variety of different scenarios. Then the following week, we've got Cliff High, who was a software developer at a very large software company, and over time discovered ways of using software to literally scan the web and discern what people were thinking and feeling about future events. He has a website called, he and his partners, called Half Past Human. And literally what they do is they produce, it's subscriber-only, reports for subscribers that describe what the internet is saying about what's going to happen over the next year or two and what are the concerns that are most on people's minds. It's very intuitive material. It's very almost hard to read because you're literally reading, you're trying to read the psychic storm. And one of the things that Cliff has found in the web searches is evidence coming back or indication coming back that there's great expectation that we will see a real collapse of the dollar this year and a very difficult period from May until the fall. He calls it the summer of hell. And there's some pretty dire stuff there, but it's very, I would say it's very useful, and it's scenarios that will inform. One of the things about it I most want you to hear about is really what is on people's mind, what are they thinking about, what are they talking about, because it really is very informative. It's one of the things that inspired me to talk about geography as destiny. So April is going to be exploring the worst case month at the Solari Reports, and I really hope that information inspires you to think about what actions you can take in your life. I wanted to talk briefly about what I call living with the ostriches in your life. One of the things that happens to people once they hook into Solari and the Solari Report is they come to me and say, I've been learning all this fantastic information about what's really going on, and I've tried to share it with my friends and family, and they don't want to hear it. What should I do? And what I try to impress upon people is it's interesting. You'll find some people really want to know what's going on, and other people really don't want to know what's going on. And they split out into two groups, people who just want to know what they should do, and people who really think that things are fine. And it's very important, I have found, to only share with, to share information about what's really going on with people who really want to know it. And if others find it too frightening or too threatening because they can't imagine how things could be that different from what they expect, that it's very important to use your knowledge, including any knowledge you gain at Solari, in a way that will help people accomplish what they want in their life, but will not burden with them with information about risk issues that they really don't want to know. My practice is that it's very, very important to give people energy. And what I like to do is use my knowledge to give them energy, but not to talk about things that they find frightening or simply mean that they just have to change their point of view and their life in a way that they can't afford to. So I try and organize my information so that I can give them energy and be useful to them, you know, and love them without necessarily having to share or talk about the same map. So it's really important, I think, to love people, but not to require them to necessarily embrace with you an understanding of the real deal, if literally that is something that they just can't handle. And we're coming into a period where if you're around people who are willing to take action but really don't want to talk about what's going on, there's a lot of alignment you can create around taking positive action without having to get into the deeper issues of what's really happening. Now, one of the things, I just gave a speech to a wonderful audience in Cleveland, and what happened at the end is I sat down with a group of people and they said, okay, what are we going to do? And I said something I've said in many speeches. Some of you have heard me say it. I'm going to say it again. And that is, I can't tell you how important it is in 2009 to protect your time. One of my favorite quotes from the Buddha is, the Buddha says, your problem is you think you have time. We're coming into an environment, whether it's what happens with the climate, it's what happens with the corruption, it's what happens with the economy, where more and more things, sort of centralized systems, are going to be more unreliable. There are going to be more hiccups in a variety of things. You know, things like local crime could happen. All of these different phenomena potentially use your time. And so all of us could have burdens placed on our time far in excess of what we currently estimate. And it is very important to sit down, and this is what I try and do every year, literally do a chart of the sources and uses of your time. How much time do you have, and where do you spend that time? And if there is anything in terms of your investment of time that is not giving you energy, just cut it out. You need to be as ruthless as possible. It's one of the reasons I really harp on not watching TV, because if you can take, if you can literally just cancel 3 hours a week of TV and instead use that time to have a potluck dinner with your neighbors or people you know and trust, to start to go to work on how you create local, much greater local self-sufficiency and you know, self-protect or sort of community protection, that could be an investment that really makes a difference. And just prepare to have the time you need. So if any of these different things come up, you're protected and it doesn't create impossible stress on you. the what we're seeing across the board as you watch the flow of information coming out of Washington. We have more and more regulations being proposed, more and more things that could take your time or money. And the interesting thing is there are 20 different things. There's not one big thing, but 20 different kinds of things, all of which potentially eat up your time and money. And it's very subtly done. So it's not, if it was just one action, then everybody could be clear, but it's this and that and this and that. And it's 1,000 cuts. So those things are coming down, and it's very important that if we're going to succeed in this environment, that we be able to handle them very astutely without losing our temper and without getting frustrated and getting angry, because we're literally in a game, if you will, and it's so important to be able to sort of handle it successfully. One of the things that happened in Cleveland, we had an audience of about, I would say about 50% of the audience was African American, 50% was Caucasian or other. And at one point, the speaker before me talked about how important it was that we help low-income communities and minority communities. And finally, what I said is something which I very much believe, which is, if you look at the environment that the whole population is going into, in minority communities, they used to call it a beatdown. Now the whole population is going into a beatdown. But if you look at the technology and the knowledge of how to deal with a beatdown and be successful and overcome it, all that knowledge is in the minority communities and the poorer communities. Because, in fact, if you've lived successfully through the war on drugs in a minority community, then you know an awful lot about how this game of 20 cuts works. And so one of the things I encouraged the audience to do was, instead of helping those communities, we had middle and upper middle income communities that still had capital, but we had lower income communities that knew how the game worked. And somehow, if we could bring the capital together and the knowledge of how the game worked, we could really help each other in this situation in a remarkable way. And I truly believe that. So I don't know which one of those two communities you're in, but I would encourage you to reach out and see if you couldn't be part of connecting the two, because there are people in this country who are remarkable at dealing with this game, and they're there, and their technology and knowledge is accessible to us. We've just never used it before, but that doesn't mean we can't seek them out and use it. Okay, so that's it. The first quarter has been a real turning point, and my expectation, though, is that's going to accelerate. The United States and the world in 2010 is going to look very, very different than it did in 2008. And within that, it's great change, but there's going to be a lot of opportunities. I'm constantly asked, where can I go and what can I do to be safe? And I've said many times, and I'm going to say it again, the question to ask yourself is, where is your heart? And with whom and where do you want to create safety? Because it's really by being attracted to what you want to create that you're going to create the kind of safety that you want for you and your family. So in closing, let me just note, again, we've put up a subscriber access link on each page of the website, so that way it's much easier for you to reach the control panel if you need to. Our next goal for the Solari report, which we're going to be working on probably, we hope to bring it up sometime in mid or late summer, is a private online forum so that subscribers can communicate and post and discuss and form communities of interest if they want online. We've had a great comment or suggestion that folks would like transcripts, and that's on our to-do list, but probably after we get the forum going. Please keep suggesting possible guests. If there's somebody you'd like to have me on or issues you want me to address, I just really appreciate your comments and feedback. Keep it coming. Next week, when we talk with Franklin on the precious metals, the movie will be The International, starring Clive Owens. It should still be in theaters around you. It's a great, great description of the dependency of the sort of centralized economy on debt, on warfare, and on all sorts of financial fraud. If you really want to see the red button problem up close, the Midianite thing happening, it's all there. It's just a, I can't say it's the most entertaining movie because it's depressing to contemplate, but it really helps you understand the business model and the challenge of trying to change anything from within the enforcement or the government community. And again, following Franklin, Dmitry Orlov on April 15th and Cliff Hive on April 23rd. And remember, as you listen to these again, I don't want to scare you to death with the worst case, but I really encourage you to explore the worst case with us, because it will inspire you to make excellent changes that will be great for you in a slow burn or any of the other scenarios. So until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.